Welcome, everyone. Well, should we just listen to Dylan music for 45 minutes? That wouldn't be a bad way to spend an evening. It's a lot better to listen to what Aaron and I have to say.
Speak for yourself, Mark.
Yes.
I did something on Bob Dylan at the ACU lectures about, I don't know, 15 years ago, I guess. And a room like this, a lot of veteran rock and rollers, you know, came out of the woodwork for that. And then there were a lot of college students there who really knew Dylan, which kind of surprised me. And a friend of mine played songs and sang. And during it, one guy was rocking back and forth. His eyes were shut. And he was in a different place. And he came up to me after the session. He handed me a book of lyrics, of Dylan's lyrics. And I couldn't tell if he was saying, I want to congratulate you for doing a good job, or, son, you need to read Dylan's lyrics more closely before you talk about the great Dylan. I said, well, how did I do? He said, you did great. He said, you get Dylan. He said, I think Dylan tapped into what Jung called the collective subconscious. And he said, I feel like I have tapped into that, and I'm pretty sure you have too, which was news to me because I didn't even know what it was. Right?
I got that going for you.
Yeah.
Which is nice.
So he says, I got there by dropping acid. I assume you're getting there some other way. So if you've got a story like that you'd like to share, we're open to that tonight. How many of you have seen Dylan more than once in concert? Anybody? What? How many of you seen Dylan in concert? Anybody? A few.
We may have.
Yeah, you may have.
It's only possible.
Well, if you remember the 60s, you weren't there.
Yeah. Yeah. So, how many of you are early Dylan folk music people?
Yeah.
How many of you felt betrayed when he went electric?
Yeah,
a few of you, yeah. Anybody like a big fan of the gospel years, the three albums from Slow Train Coming through? Yeah, I'm a huge fan of the music. Not so much of the theology on those albums. We'll talk about that a little bit more. But it took me a while to kind of get into Dylan. I'm not a big folk music guy. I'm more of a three-chord rock and roll kind of guy. And then the voice, you know, it's an acquired taste, right? Although, my wife hates Dylan, will not listen to it, thinks it's horrible, awful. I told her, though, I read a quote from Tony Bennett, who said, Dylan is one of the greatest singers of our age. He was dead serious.
Wow.
And he said, it's not necessarily vocal quality, but not since Sinatra has someone been able to phrase a song like Dylan.
That's high praise.
Yeah. So, but I didn't see all that in the early music, but I caught him around modern times and the more recent stuff in the 90s. In the early 2000s, when he kind of reappeared, he won some Grammys, and his music had changed, and his voice had changed, and it sounded like somebody ran barbed wire over his vocal cords for a long time, but it fit the music for me, and that was kind of my road back in Dylan. So we've titled tonight something, The Apocalyptic Some or Other, Bob Dylan. The important word there is apocalyptic, and Aaron and I are both going to talk about that, but in a little bit different ways. But we kind of want to define apocalyptic a little bit for you. If you have an apocalyptic worldview, then you think the world is unredeemable in its current form, that there's no amount of human effort that can make the world a better place, that the only way the world will improve is if the world as we know it ends and a new world breaks in. And obviously we think there's a lot of that in Dylan's music, and we've been playing some of those songs as you came in. So that's what we mean by apocalyptic. The Bible, the New Testament, is primarily apocalyptic. The kingdom of God has come near. All other ways of ordering the world have been judged. And now through the dramatic coming of the Spirit, a new world is possible. That's kind of the apocalyptic move. So, Aaron, you're quite young to know Dylan music. Tell me how you got there.
Thanks, Mark. I often say that Bob Dylan saved my ministry. I've been working in churches in the Northwest now for 12 years professionally, 10 years at my current church, Westside Church of Christ, and 2 years before that at a different church. And Bob Dylan really saved my ministry, kind of came to me at a pivotal time. I
personally came to you? Okay.
We'll get there. Right. You have any advice, Richard, for when you're co-teaching with Mark, you just push through?
Yeah, you just push through.
So it's actually kind of funny because years before kind of my conversion over to Bob Dylan happened, I was living with Mark for a while at ACU, just kind of in between. I can't remember why I was living with you, but there I was. And Mark had just gotten a collection of Bob Dylan CDs that he was really excited about. And I kind of was following Mark around in everything that he did. And so one day when Mark wasn't home, I stole all the CDs and, you know, put them on my computer, because that's the way you had to get CDs back then. And then they just sat there forever, and I never listened to them again. I couldn't get into the music. It just kind of wasn't making sense.
You can buy CDs. You don't have to steal them.
After if you're staying with Mark Love, though. So I started it in ministry, and I was absolutely crashing and burning. Like, nothing was working out. I was at it was in a very difficult ministry environment up in the Northwest, and I was just about ready to quit. I mean, I was minutes away from quitting. We had just had our second child, who was our blue-eyed son named Miles, and his lungs were, like, filled with air that he loved to release at top volume in the middle of the night. He was this spirited child, and so we were running on lack of sleep and an ungrateful environment at church, and it kind of reached this pinnacle point. I had been sent a letter by a church member who called me Judas and was wishing me to die as Judas died, and the leadership wasn't doing anything about that. Their words were, he's a big contributor, you need to do something about that. And I would preach, and him and his wife would literally open up a newspaper, The Oregonian, right in front of me to kind of publicly protest. So I'm just done, and I'm, you know, frustrated beyond words. So me and Shalane, my wife, we take a respite and go stay a few days with my mother-in-law in Vancouver. And we're at my mother-in-law's house, Bonnie's house. And, of course, if you know Bonnie, she's not going to have cable, TV, or internet access.
Anything after 1850.
Anything after 1850, yeah. She's a TV that runs off kerosene. So running the kerosene, burning the midnight oil, and holding Miles as he's not going to sleep. And just kind of in, you know, this place of frustration. And Martin Scorsese's documentary came on, No Direction Home, which is a really interesting documentary about Bob Dylan's life. And I was just kind of watching it in the background, and I'm just kind of paying attention to it with Miles. And then it gets to the place in Dylan's life in the 1960s when he decides to go electric. And he's going electric, and crowds, like, aren't appreciating it, to say the least. He plays the first half of the concert's acoustic, then when he switches to electric, they boo him, they shout at him, they yell at him. And so it's kind of talking about the stage of his life, but he doesn't stop doing it no matter what. So there's this one scene it's recorded in 1966 when he's playing in Manchester, England. It's a well-known event that takes place. Somebody yells out on the stage and yells to him and calls him Judas. And when, I mean, he says that, I just look up because I'm like, this like literally just happened to me pretty recently. And Dylan screams back at the guy and says, "You're a liar, you're wrong," and then turns around and yells some profane words to his band, essentially saying, "Play really loud," and continues to play like a Rolling Stone with his back face to the audience the whole time, just jamming away at this song. Okay, there was something about the way that he did that that absolutely captivated me, because there was something prophetic about it, that it wasn't even about him in that moment, it was about the music, and the music had to be played even if he was getting booed. Like, he knew what was right, and he wasn't going to stop playing the music. And when I saw that, I just kind of felt this sense of, I don't know, urgency about getting to know Bob Dylan. So I opened up my laptop and found all the songs I had stolen from Mark and started really kind of diving deep into Dylan lyrics, especially the songs Hard Rain's Gonna Fall. What was the other one I told you? Maggie's Farm and It Ain't Me, Babe became really captivating to me. Kind of the courage that was taking place in these songs kind of gave me a second wind in ministry. So there's something about it, and I also loved all the interviews he was doing around that time that were fascinating to me, because he hated to be interviewed. And if you haven't watched just YouTube his interviews from those early years, they're hysterical to watch, because he won't answer any questions straight out. You know, they ask him a question, and he just says, "Well, I think I'm more of a song and dance man, you know, I'm not really, I wouldn't consider myself." He's just kind of always elusive, because there's a sense of, he's like curious that they're asking him about himself, like he doesn't care, because for him it's just all about the music. The music needs to be played, the music is what's right. And so in my ministry, I started kind of doubling down on this, and I thought, you know, it's not about me or how I'm being treated, it's about this message being shared. This is what has to happen. I never did preach with my back to that church, but I was so close one Sunday. I just thought, what if I just turned my back to the church? I still kind of wish I would have done it.
Or maybe what if you'd open the newspaper?
Yes.
Newspaper.
Oh, that's a good idea.
Maybe they'll invite you back.
Yeah. Yeah, so I kind of got this courage from it. And the line in the song, "It's a Hard Rain That's Going to Fall," that he ends with, where he says, "I'm going to know my song well before I start singing," gave me this sense of, you know, I'm going to do this better than I ever have. And I started working double hard on my sermons. I started spending twice the amount of time, and I thought, if I'm kind of going out, I'm going out in the best way I possibly can. So as I've been reflecting on that from a kind of apocalyptic sense, I think about Bob Dylan and his use of I. So if I titled the class now, I would have called it "The I in Apocalyptic." Especially in the song "The Hard Rain's Gonna Fall," or "Where Have You Been, My Blue-Eyed Son," or "Where Have You Been, My Darling Young One?" "I've stumbled on side of 12 misty mountains. I've walked and I've crawled on 6 crooked highways. I've stepped in the middle of 7 sad forests." He kind of has this eye that's really not him, of course, Bob Dylan, but it's this kind of collective consciousness, I suppose, this kind of identity. I like to think of it as a conduit that's bringing in this message that has to be given to the people. So in a sense, I kind of removed myself from the equation in my sermons and in my work in service of this broader thing that I felt like had to be shared. So that was kind of my entrance into Bob Dylan, and ever since then, I've just absorbed his music. I have a huge picture of him up on my wall in my office. It gets a lot of strange questions. But I kind of feel this sense of courage from him that I think is close to the apocalyptic, prophetic kind of courage.
So what about Maggie's Farm? ain't going to work on Maggie's farm no more.
Yeah.
No hired hand at church. You're,
yeah.
Been liberated from that.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't have to be here with you anymore. I'm doing it. Yeah.
And was he the one?
It Ain't Me, Babe. Yeah. Is one that has kind of come to me recently. I was reading a really good book called The Monk's Record Player that just came out, and it's Thomas Merton's experience with Bob Dylan. Thomas Merton's a huge Bob Dylan fan and wrote he wanted to write an entire essay on Bob Dylan, or even a partial book on Bob Dylan, as a prophet, as a poet prophet. But he reflects a lot on It Ain't Me, Babe. He loves that song because it's kind of Dylan's goodbye to the folk world, and it's essentially Dylan saying, I'm not who you wanted me to be this whole time. You had all these expectations for me, and that's not who I am. And man, anybody who's worked in ministry knows everybody's got 1,000 agendas for you. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of find a certain solace in saying, that ain't me, babe. You should probably go find someone else.
Yeah, that's a fairly common refrain for Dylan, like, in the album Oh Mercy, it's my favorite Dylan album, I think. He has a song called What Was It You Wanted? And he's like talking to his fans. What was it you wanted? I'm not that guy, you know. You came with expectations. I don't feel any burden to meet those, you know. So it, that shows up as kind of a Dylan motif over and over again. And I think you're right. He's been more straightforward later in life in interviews. But even then, you don't know if Dylan's coming at you straight or if he's pranking you. You know, like the whole Christmas album. You know, like, does he really think that this will put people in a Christmas mood? Or is he saying, you guys will buy anything? You know? The Christmas album kind of went, it kind of went too far for me. I don't have as kind of a, like, Dylan didn't come to me or save my life or... But I have found Dylan compelling. In fact, I've had two blogs. In the first one, I wrote a little piece every Sunday called Dylan on Sunday. And I would just comment on a lyric or a song or a mood or a vibe or... I'm not big on phrases like the gospel according to Dylan. I'm not sure I know what that is or if he would attach the word gospel to anything he's doing. So it seems to me to be a little bit imperialist on my part to kind of make him say something that he might not be saying. But I do like to think about the world imagined by an artist, whether it's Dylan or Springsteen or Marvin Gaye or whoever. Oftentimes you can tie the body of their work together around a primary imagination about the world. And most thoughtful artists are going to have theological, sometimes specific, out there references. You know, bands like U2 obviously have very concrete, obvious references to their faith. But some are more under the surface of the song or the lyrics. They're in a phrase or an allusion, or even in protest. Like, you know, REM, I think, is a really interesting theological band, but they're But their theological observations are all about the problems they have with faith. They've imagined, though, a world, and I think the key to being a good, I don't want to use the word consumer, but a good listener to an artist is the ability to enter the world on the artist's terms to the extent that you can. So I'm thinking, what's the world imagined by Dylan? And like, he's been around a really long time, right? You know, he's in his late 70s now. He won't stand and play guitar now through a whole concert, I think, because it's hard on his hands. He plays keyboard now a lot for the majority of his live performances. He's been around a long time, and there have been changes in his sound, you know, from folk to electric, but then even he played around with some kind of country stuff in there for a while, and then in the gospel albums he brought in Mark Knopfler, of all people, to play with him on gospel albums, and brought in African-American gospel singers as background singers for those albums, really changed the sound of a Dylan album. But then he worked with Daniel Lanois kind of late in his career, and talks about it in his autobiography, which is a great, it's a volume one, and I'm waiting for volume two. It's been out for 10 or 12 years now. It's a great read, and he talks about kind of discovering a new kind of musical rhythm, and to me it's like big tires on smooth pavement. It just rolls, you know, and it's very bass driven, and he's had the same bass player now for several, way more than you want to know about Dylan's music. But
that's why they're here, Mark.
The point is, musically, there's been a lot of diversity over a long career, and now he's doing the torch songs, right? The standards, the old standards, the Sinatra songs, and I like them better than the Christmas album, but still, you know, it's a...
Shalane, for my birthday this last year, bought me on vinyl, like, the full albums, the three albums of those.
Yeah.
She's like, do you love it? And I was listening to them, and I was like, thank you, babe. The price tag was like $60, so I was like,
So, is there a Dylan world that encompasses all that? Right, and he writes, he's a very kind of idiosyncratic lyricist. He's a great lyricist, but rhyme is more important than message a lot of times. Someone asked him in an interview if he thought he could write a song about the presidency of George W. Bush. He said, sure, not a lot of words that rhyme with Bush. So sometimes lyrically, he's kind of all over the place, and he's gone for what sounds right rather than kind of a consistent message throughout a song. Still, over time, the one thing that appears, I think, consistently from beginning to end is this notion of apocalyptic. And it's certainly, so if that's true, and there are biblical allusions in Dylan's work from the very beginning up until now, his original songs, he is always alluding to scripture and using biblical references in his music. He knows scripture very well, particularly the Old Testament, right? He grew up in a Jewish home. these are the words and the cadences and the poetry that kicked around and formed his musical imagination. So they're showing up everywhere. And the question is, how's he using it? Is he using it the way he thinks the Bible is, or is it just a line that he liked that he's incorporated? And you never quite know. But from beginning to end, in Dylan's career, there are apocalyptic images. So hard rain's going to fall. You know, be careful, you people, gather around. No, that's...
Times
are changing. So come gather around, people, wherever you roam, and admit that the waters around you have grown, and accept it that soon you'll be drenched to the bone. If your time to you is worth saving, then you better start swimming or you'll sink like a stone, for the times, they are changing. In the song Masters of War, which is a haunting, haunting song, Dylan sings against the military-industrial complex and imagines a world where they will be brought low, and the possibility of a new world might emerge. So it's in the early music. So if you were listening, and Dylan himself says this, when people say, where did this Christian thing come from for you? And he said at one point, if you were listening, these things have been in my music from the very beginning. And he's right. And if you were listening, you wouldn't be surprised to find out that in the late 70s, he was converted to a brand of Christianity that was fairly fundamentalist, very much dispensational in their theology, very much part of the kind of Hal Lindsey, late great planet Earth kind of stuff, speculating about the end times. I mean, Dylan was huge in that. He was converted to a Vineyard, the Vineyard congregation, the original congregation here in L.A., and went to Bible studies every week. It's a really remarkable story. There's a new book out about the Christian years of Dylan's life that kind of talked through kind of what he went through during that time. But I'm saying this is precisely the kind of Christianity that would have appealed to Dylan if you've been listening over time. I've got to see if we can... The sound's not great on it, but I've got a YouTube thing.
Doesn't he live in Malibu?
He does.
We tried to find him.
We tried. We knocked on every door in Malibu.
We knocked on a lot of houses, but I don't know if he's ever been...
Arizona, I think it was someplace. Is that where it was? Were you there? Hold on, right? Anyway, I read the Bible a lot, you know. I mean, it's just what it just happens I do. And so it says certain things in the Bible that I wasn't really aware of until just recently. You know, at universities, they're, you know, it's like they have a higher learning people there. They teach them different, like, philosophies. And so people, they study all these different philosophies. You know, Plato and who else? Who? Jimmy Reed. I can't remember all the names. Nietzsche and those people like that. Anyways... In the Bible, it has specific, it tells you specific things in the book of Daniel and in the book of Revelation, which just might apply to these times here. And It says there's certain wars that are soon about going to happen. I can't say exactly when, you know, but say pretty soon anyway. And so at that time, you know, it mentions a country to the furthermost north, and it has its symbol called the bear. Now that, and also, it also is spelled R-O-S-H in the Bible. Now, this was written 30 years ago. So it can't really but apply to one country that I know. I mean, if you know another country, it can apply to, maybe you do, I don't know. But then there's another country called, I can't remember what the name of it is, but it's in the eastern part of the world, and it's got an army of 200 million foot soldiers. Now, there's only one country that could actually be. So anyway, I was telling the story to these people. I shouldn't have been telling it to them. I just got carried away. And I mentioned to them, well, you know, watch now, because Russia is going to come down and attack the Middle East. It says this in the Bible. And I've been reading all kinds of books my whole life, magazines, books, or whatever I could get my hand on anywhere. And I really never found any truth in any of them, if you want to know the truth. But these things in the Bible, they seem to uplift me and tell me the truth. So I said this country is going to come down and attack, and all these people, there must have been 50,000. If there was one, that's right. No, I don't know. There wasn't 50,000. There was, I don't know, maybe 3,000. They all just booed. You know, like they usually do? They don't like them. Just booed. And there was a whole auditorium of people just, I said, Russia's going to attack the Middle East. And they went, boo. You know, they couldn't hear that. They didn't believe it. And a month later, Russia moved their troops into, I think, Afghanistan. And the whole situation changed, you know. And I'm not saying this to tell you that I, you know, that they were wrong and I was right or anything like that, but these things that it mentions in the Bible, I pay mighty close attention to. So it does say that, talking about.
So, this is the brand of Christianity that Dylan bought into, a very apocalyptic kind of Christianity, and premillennial, obviously. And think about what's going on here, right? We're moving into the Reagan presidency. It's kind of the height of the Cold War. People are you know, speculating about a big confrontation between the Soviet Union and the U.S. It's not hard to see how someone, you know, being brought into that world with those kind of dispositions already in place wouldn't see a lot of interest or a compelling imagery in this kind of thing. My own theory about Dylan's faith is that it's not gone, but it changed. And it changed primarily because that kind of narrative is really hard to sustain for a long period of time. Because then the Soviet Union falls, and suddenly you have to reread Revelation and Daniel, right? And so it's a hard kind of faith to kind of sustain. But his 1980 album, Oh Mercy, is kind of a move away from the three Christian albums, starting with Slow Train Coming. And I don't know if you've ever listened to Slow Train Coming. It's a brilliant album musically. I love it. And you know, You Gotta Serve Somebody is on that album. He won a Grammy for that song. It's beautifully produced. it's just, it rocks. It's a great album. I've recently refurbished my turntable and reinvested in buying vinyl, and that was one of the first albums that I bought, and I've just loved listening to those albums. Theology's really bad, but the music's really good. So, but Oh Mercy is kind of a move out of that world, and I think a transition album into his later stuff like Modern Times and albums like that. I know you're kind of getting glazy. Are we going to talk about Blowing in the Wind? When's that going to come up, right? But there are several songs on Oh Mercy that have explicit Christian themes and, again, are very apocalyptic. One is the song "The Man in the Long Black Coat," or "Ring Them Bells." We're ringing bells to warn of the loss of a world and the discovery of a new one. The song "Everything Is Broken" is kind of the ultimate, that there's no way to fix the world. And it's a great song. If you heard that song, you want to hear a little bit of it? Yeah, you do, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Why not?
And this is kind of... this is kind of my favorite Dylan sound.
Can I interject something right here?
Yeah.
One of the things I found fascinating in the book, The Monk's Record Player, one of the elements of Bob Dylan's music that Thomas Merton loved was what theologians call the via negativa, the kind of the presence of God through the absence of God, the kind of naming the places that God is not. And Thomas Merton really picked up on that in many of Bob Dylan's lyrics, which I think that one hits it directly on. So kind of the naming of everything that's wrong in the world. That's what Thomas Merton himself at the time was really wrapped up in trying to do in a loud and a public way as possible. He was, you know, very against the new liturgy of the Catholic Church that was happening and all of the things that were happening in the world with Vietnam. And so he was trying to scream as loud as he could, "Everything is broken." And he really found the counterpart in Bob Dylan's lyrics.
There are kind of motifs that appear early and late in Dylan's music. There's a section in the book of Jeremiah that uses the end of summer as a metaphor for the end of Judah's life as a nation and the eventual destruction of Judah. And the prophet Jeremiah is talking, am I saying that right? Yeah. So I'm really tired and old. And
everything's broken.
Everything's broken. And Jeremiah is critiquing the cult of the king, the kind of the royal mentality, the royal ideology, by talking about the great excesses of the court while everything around it's going to hell, right? So Dylan has two songs, one early, one late, that both have the word summer in title, and both are allusions to this section in the book of Jeremiah. One of them, I think, is on Modern Times, one of the 90s albums, and the images that Dylan adds to, like Jeremiah talks about, you know, that the hogs are fat, and that shows up in Dylan's, in the lyrics in Dylan's song. But then he contemporizes the song by saying, I've got eight carburetors, all of them are roaring. And so kind of one image of excess and opulence on top of another. And it's, in Jeremiah's language, this is the end of the world when those who are wealthy and those who are in power are living in luxury while everyone around them is in need and in want. So that shows up again late in Dylan's music. My favorite Dylan song of all time is from the movie The Wonder Boys, and it's called Everything's Changed. Is that what it's called?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's not up there yet. Things have changed. And it's a great lyric. People are crazy and times are strange. I'm locked in tight. I'm out of range. I used to care, but things have changed. And one of the lines in that song is, if the Bible is right, the world's gonna explode. I'm trying to get as far away from myself as I can. Which is a great lyric. I love that lyric. So again, Dylan's world, you know, the levee's always about to break in a Dylan song. You know, and a catastrophe's just around the corner. And there's nothing that we can do to stave it off. The only thing that will make things better is a brand new world that breaks into our reality. And it's in the early songs, it's in the late songs, it's surely part of the so-called gospel albums of the early 80s. So in that way, I have found Bob Dylan a really lively conversation partner as a theologian who's trying to think about how people engage the world or view the world. And Dylan has certainly been a huge cultural icon that's shaped perceptions of the world for many people for many years. So, anything else you want?
No, I'm good. Thanks, Mark.
Anything you want? You want to say?
How has this been, hearing all this for a minute or two?
Yeah.
Rick Nielsen, Garden Party. Does that relate to Dylan's approach at all? In other words, you know, Rick Nielsen's the lyrics in Garden Party, you know, he's kind of had it with a lot of stuff.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't know Rick Nielsen. I mean, I know he's. I know who he is, but.
Okay, sorry.
I don't know his music.
People wanted to hear the old songs. People wanted to hear Rick Nielsen's new song.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he changed and people couldn't deal with it.
Yeah.
Have to play at garden parties, I'd rather drive a truck, which yeah. sounds like Elvis reference.
Yeah. That doesn't relate to churches at all, though. Right.
Yeah.
Does he have any kids that are musicians?
Yeah, his son, Jacob Dylan.
Jacob Dylan is almost just as good, in my mind.
Yeah, as a lyricist. Yeah. He had a band called the Wallflowers. In fact, I went for, like in the... think the early to mid 90s, I stopped listening to music, which is really, really weird to me that I stopped listening. And I think I was depressed. And I went to a church camp out, and they have those little Sony Discmans, and someone had the Wallflowers CD, and having the earbuds in and listening to One Headlight kind of awakened me again to music, and I started buying it again and finding
new
groups.
See, Dylan did come to you. It was just the other Dylan.
The other Dylan. So he's got a couple of great solo albums that T-Bone Burnett produced, and what's her name? The New Pornographers lead singer. Anyway, great band on the great. He's got several kids that we know of. Likely even more. He was married for a long time. No one knew about it. He married one of his backup singers during the gospel period, and no one knew about it for a long time. So just biographically, he's a very interesting guy too. I mean, how Robert Zimmerman became Bob Dylan, and then how that persona became him. At first, he was trying to become the persona. Anyway, it's a fascinating kind of career and story to think about and ponder.
The Traveling Wilburys was an interesting period.
Yeah, and that really brought him back. You know, he went through a lull there after the... that was before the Christian albums.
Do you know, I've been told that Roy Orbison was a member of the church.
I've not heard that.
Across that.
I know where that is.
He was a very godly man, I know that.
Huh. That's interesting. Yeah, that kind of, Dylan had lost any kind of musical fire for a while. And the albums right before Traveling Wilburys were bombs. They were, and he talks about, he thought he might be finished as an artist. But then the Traveling Wilburys kind of
good stuff
created a little energy again for him. And yeah, when you're making music with George Harrison and Jeff Lynne or Roy Orbison, that's a pretty good band. Yeah.
Well, thanks for hanging with us.
How many people cover his songs?
I cover them.
No, but I mean, Peter, Paul, and Mary did some of it. You know, that's how I got to know him. You know, Peter, Paul, and Mary's versions, like Blowing in the Wind, which, did you talk about that?
No. My favorite cover is Show You My Love, who Garth Brooks has covered it, but Adele's the one that everyone knows. And no one has any idea that Dylan wrote and recorded that song. So, yeah, everybody covers Dylan.
I think my favorite Dylan covered song is Jason Mraz's Hard Rain's Gonna Fall.
Really?
It's haunting. You don't like that
one? No, I like Eddie Vedder's Masters of War.
That's a good one for you.
That would be... So, talk amongst yourself. We're done. Thanks for coming.